Would you like some water?
I'm fine. I guess when I speak, I should know that.
I think so. And then when we do the questions, you probably want to stay up there unless you ever work through whichever is better.
Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Council on Foreign Relations, I would like you to welcome you to tonight's program, Hedge Funds, Heroes or Villains. We are honored to have with us this evening Sebastian Mallaby, author of More Money Than God, Hedge Funds and the Making of a New Elite. I'm Nancy Jarvis, former chair and current trustee of the World Affairs Council. A quick word about the council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders can join the public in a dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, visit our website at itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, please, you can stay informed by accessing the council's podcasts and streaming audio and video online. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly radio show, It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Tonight's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Before we begin, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I'll take the opportunity to announce two upcoming events. This Thursday, September 30th, the Council is pleased to host a director of the McKinsey Global Institute and World Affairs Council trustee, James Manyika, to present a new report on the causes of Africa's recent growth, its economic outlook, and emerging opportunities for business. I know James well, and I know that all of his comments are insightful and cutting edge, and I commend the program to you. It will take place in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Then on Wednesday, October 15th, the Council will host former Rio de Janeiro Bureau Chief for the New York Times, Larry Roeder, to discuss Brazil's recent rise and what it means for the whole of South America. This event will also be held here at the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Finally, I encourage you to use the blue question cards on your seats. Please hand them to Council staff members for use in the question period during the second half of the program. It is now my privilege to introduce our distinguished guest. Sebastian Mallaby is the director of the Maurice Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies, the deputy of the David Rockefeller Studies Program, and a Paul Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Mr. Mallaby is an experienced journalist, having worked on the Washington Post as a columnist and editorial board member and for The Economist. While at The Economist, Mr. Mallaby worked in London, where he wrote about international finance, in Africa, where he covered Nelson Mandela's release from prison and the collapse of apartheid, and in Japan, where he witnessed the breakdown of the country's political and economic consensus. Between 1997 and 1999, he was The Economist's Washington Bureau Chief and wrote the magazine's weekly column on American politics and foreign policy. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist for editorials on Darfur and for a series on economic inequality. In 2003, Mr. Mallaby came to the Council on Foreign Relations, where he wrote a book on the World Bank under James Wolfensohn, which was described as the most hilarious depiction of a big organization and its controversial boss since Michael Lewis's Liar's Poker. His latest book, More Money Than God, has won a nomination for the 2010 Business Book of the Year Award by the Financial Times and has been called a primer on America's most obscenely lucrative investment tool. Please join me in welcoming Sebastian Mallaby.
Thank Well, thanks for the introduction, and it's great to be here. So I'm going to talk about this book, More Money Than God. I picked the title because in 1913, the banker J.P. Morgan died, and his fortune in today's dollars came to $1.4 billion. And many of the characters in my book make more than that in a single year. When J.P. Morgan died, you know, he was known as Jupiter because of his godlike power over Wall Street. So these guys in my book are making more money than Jupiter, more money than God, year after year after year. I came up with the idea of doing this book back in 2006, so it's before the crisis, not a crisis book. And I had two basic motives for doing it. The first was the sense that, you know, most of the economy is pretty transparent. You can look up stuff about it on the internet. But hedge funds appear to be the last bastion of secrecy. And to an investigative writer, that was sort of seductive. The second thing was that there seemed to be an interesting cultural tension whereby in the United States mainly, people like entrepreneurs. You know, if four quantitative people set up a boutique company on the West Coast around this area, it's probably doing software and everybody loves it. It's going to be on the cover of business magazines. But if four quantitative people set up a boutique company on the East Coast in Connecticut, it's doing finance, it's a hedge fund, everybody's suspicious. Interesting. Why this cultural tension? And I thought about that. It seemed to me that it might actually be more interesting even than that. Not only was there this interesting double standard, but also people thought that hedge funds might be the least stable part of finance. Perhaps, actually, they were the most stabilizing part of finance. And that opportunity, not only to do an investigation of something people didn't know about, but also to have a contrarian bottom line, appeal to the op-ed columnist in me. At the Washington Post, my op-ed columns, the idea was to try and find a subject where most people thought A, but if you examine the evidence, B was more plausible. This seemed a classic case. People thought that hedge funds were destabilizing. The more I looked at it, the more I suspected that might be the opposite of the truth. So anyway, the question is, 4 years later, I had this plan in 2006. 4 years later, what have I learned? How have my conclusions evolved? So on the what have I learned stuff, this is why I can't resist telling you a few stories from the book, because going out and discovering about the larger-than-life characters who are drawn to hedge funds was just tremendous fun. And the point is that, you know, to be in a hedge fund, to take positions in markets, you're basically saying to yourself that although the market price out there is fairly efficient, it reflects most of the available information, it's a kind of weighted average of people's judgments about what the price of the security should be, even though all these people, these other smart people, have expressed their views through the existing price, you can do better than that. You have a different view which is actually closer to being correct. It takes some confidence to believe that you're smarter than the rest of the world. And so people with a lot of intriguing self-confidence are drawn to this field. It starts with the first character of all, Alfred Winslow Jones, who set up his hedged fund, as he called it, in 1949, a lot before most people realized that there was a hedge fund industry. And as I went around, you know, talking to all the people who worked for him as portfolio managers, discovering them in retirement in Connecticut, and then finding his children, who were still alive, I realized that there was a sort of question mark about his background, because one of his kids had married a German, and under German law, when you get married, you sort of state who your parents were married to, and in this process, A.W. Jones's son discovered that his dad hadn't been just married once, as he had thought, but twice. The first time, to a German woman. And as this story began to kind of, you know, fall into his lap, it transpired that the German wife he'd been sent to Berlin as a State Department official and had fallen in love with a beautiful anti-German left-wing activist. And he'd married not only her, but her cause. He had enrolled in the Marxist Workers' School in Berlin, an interesting place for the father of hyper-capitalist hedge funds to go and study. And he started to run underground missions to London and to Switzerland to raise money for his wife's operation. And I was able to find a cable that was sent by the British authorities back to Washington saying, this young American who's enrolled in this Marxist thing, I mean, how dangerous is he? Should we arrest him? So he was an unconventional character. He later got married a second time. He married an American wife and said to her, honey, I think we should have a honeymoon. What about the front line of the Civil War in Spain? So that's where they went and, you know, met Dorothy Parker. Hung out with Ernest Hemingway, who gave them some good scotch. And then later in life, when he was in his middle age and he needed some money, he was living in New York, he had kids, you know, his clever wheeze to actually get some money was to set up a new kind of investment vehicle, the hedge fund. And it turns out that he was not only fascinating in personal terms, but the intellectual innovation that went into creating this hedge fund was quite striking too. There were four or five characteristics of this vehicle that he created, which I think are relevant for the whole history of hedge funds, going right up to the Lehman Brothers breakdown, which is where my book sort of ends up. And these characteristics of a hedge fund are as follows. First of all, A.W. Jones said that the people working for him should put their own personal savings in the fund. If you lose money, you've got to have skin in the game. It's got to be your own cash alongside of that of the outside investors. And that remains a feature of hedge funds right up until now. Second of all, there was a performance fee, a 20% deal where the money that the fund made, the investment returns, the managers kept one-fifth. And of course, that remains a familiar feature of both hedge funds and private equity funds up until now. Then there was two tricks in portfolio construction. One was hedging. In other words, you buy some stuff in the market that you think is going to go up. Let's say you think GM is very well managed, you buy that. But then you also sell things that you think is going to go down. So you might think Ford is not very well managed, so you're selling Ford. You're buying GM, selling Ford. And this hedge means that you don't actually care if the automobile sector as a whole goes up or down, because you've got bets both ways. You've hedged that risk out. You don't care if the whole economy or the whole stock market is going up or down. You've taken a specific bet on the differential in the quality between Ford's management and General Motors management. And because you've hedged out all that other risk that you didn't have a view on, like the trends in General Motors sales, because you've hedged out that risk, you can take more of the specific risk that you do think you know about, namely the difference in the quality of management. So you expand your exposure to that risk by borrowing money, and that's the leverage. You borrow money to expand your exposure to that second kind of risk. So it's this combination of speculative means, going short, and borrowing money for leverage, speculative means but for conservative ends, as A.W. Jones said, that enabled him to kind of single out the type of risk that he wanted to make a bet on. And that, again, is a feature of hedge funds right through their history. And then finally, there's a thing which he didn't emphasize, but in my book I do emphasize, because I think it turns out to be very important, which is that he was a freestanding small boutique. And later on in the history of hedge funds, there are hedge funds who were created as subsidiaries of big banks, maybe subsidiaries of private equity outfits. These, I think, don't have the attractive features of hedge funds because they've got deep-pocketed parents, and I'll come back to that later. So I think these are the things, the kind of the performance fee, which gives you an incentive to go for the upside, the money in the fund, an incentive to protect yourself on the downside, not to take too much risk, the hedging, the leverage, and the independence. After writing about the character of Alfred Winslow Jones, I go on to talk about Michael Steinhardt, who made a lot of money in the 1970s and 80s. And he was an interesting character because partly because of his temper. You know, when somebody would screw up on his staff, you know, he would yell at them so much, his face would start going red at the bottom, I was told, and it would kind of get redder and redder right up to the top. And he had a kind of intercom system such that he could target a specific employee he wanted to ream out, but it would also be broadcast to other people in other bits of the office so they could all listen in on the performance. And he was so terrifying when he lost his temper with you that, you know, one guy who'd made a mistake came up to him and said, you know, boss, all I want to do is kill myself. To which Steinhardt answered, can I watch? So he was a tough boss to work for, but he was also, again, interesting intellectually because he discovered, although he was trained as a stock picker like A.W. Jones, when he was sitting on the trading desk, he was never happier than when he was taking a call saying, will you buy some obscenely big amount of IBM or some other stock? One phone call, can you make the decision? His dad was a compulsive, addictive gambler. He was always being hauled out of Las Vegas with yet more personal debts. And Steinhardt found that there was nothing like the rush you could get sitting in your pizza-strewn trading room with a buddy. You know, he had this sidekick who did it with him, and they competed as to who could smoke more cigarettes per day. Steinhardt would smoke two at once, but the other guy smoked faster, so the other guy claimed to me that he smoked more. But in any event, they would sit there, and they would get these calls, and they would say, will you buy, you know, 400,000 stocks of IBM, yes or no? And Steinhardt became, in his ability to say yes or no, he became the human version of the modern high-frequency trader, which you've probably read about maybe in the press. It's a big controversy right now as to whether the computerized split-second trading is good or bad for markets. And Steinhardt was sort of the in his time, the fastest version of trading that existed. And he made a lot of money, because what happened was that once he was in a position where brokers that needed to move a lot of stock were used to calling him, because he was the go-to guy, because he would say yes or no in one phone call. Once he was in that position, he would get the first call, and then he would say, yeah, I will buy it, but you have to give me a dollar discount on each share. And if you think about it, the broker who's called has no choice, because if Steinhardt doesn't buy it, he puts down the phone, picks up the other phone, and immediately starts selling the same stock before you've had time to do your deal. So he front runs you. So now he's really got you where he wants you. And so he can demand maybe $1.50 off each time. So he, by being in a kind of charm circle with a reputation for being the go-to guy, was the guy to whom you went, and he milked that ruthlessly through the 70s and the 80s. I then write about a company in Princeton called Commodities Corporation. Interesting partly because they were founded with the help of the Nobel laureate, Paul Samuelson. Samuelson, of course, in his public pronouncements and his writings, believed that markets were efficient. You can't beat them. And in fact, he famously testified in Congress in the 1960s that the average professional investor would contribute more to society by becoming a plumber. And the member of Congress who was, you know, one of the members of Congress in this committee said, wait, you sure you mean this? You mean all these people in Wall Street, all they do is they're professional investors? You know, are you saying they contribute nothing? He said, yes, it would be better if they were plumbers. That's what he said publicly, privately, with his own money, the money he made from the textbook which proclaimed that markets were efficient. Privately, he put his money in a hedge fund called Commodities Corporation, which was set up partly by one of his PhD students. And what's more, he was the uncle of Larry Summers. And Larry Summers, when my book came out, I didn't know this when I was writing my book, but after my book came out, you know, Larry got in touch and said, you know, I've read your book, I've learned things about my uncle I didn't realize, but let me tell you a story. And we had dinner, and the story was like this. He said, when I was growing up, you know, my parents were academics, didn't have a lot of money, but my parents did have a nice extra wing on their home called the cocoa wing. What do you mean? Well, the thing was that Paul Samuelson, Uncle Paul, had invested with his hedge fund, Commodities Corporation, and they were very big on cocoa at a certain point, and they told my parents that cocoa was about to go up. My parents bought cocoa. It worked fantastically. They sold the cocoa. They made a lot of money, and they built a new wing on their home, the cocoa wing, and thanks to that, I had a bigger home than I would have done. More seriously, Commodities Corporation is interesting because very early on, these PhD graduate students who had studied under Samuelson got hold of a series of price data, very, very detailed on commodities price behavior. And when they looked at it carefully, they could see that it simply isn't true that there's a random walk. In fact, if prices of a certain commodity go up in time one, they have a more than 50% chance of going up in time two. And if they fall, a more than 50% of chance of going down. And so it's not like it's every time the case. Of course, it's not that the trend goes on forever. But more than 50% of the time, so if you do it a lot, the law of large numbers suggests that you will retire in great comfort. So they built one of the first computerized trend-following trading systems based on this discovery and from this very detailed price data that they had gotten from somebody, a consultant in Indianapolis. So then I looked in the academic literature for the first papers that stated that it's not a random walk and there is serial correlation in price behavior. And I found the name Scott Irwin, an academic who had his name on two of the early papers. I called him up and I said, how did you come to write this? Because, you know, from 1970 or so to mid-1980s, in academia, it was absolutely believed that it was a random walk. And Scott Irwin explained to me, it's very funny, I was a graduate student And I was in Indianapolis. I met this guy who was retired. He'd been a consultant. He had very detailed price data on commodities. And so he gave it to me. And as I was doing my PhD, I looked in these data. I could see serial correlation. It wasn't random. So I published the paper. In other words, academia got to the idea that it's not a random walk from exactly the same data from the same consultancy in Indianapolis. They just did it 15 years later than the practitioners. And that is a recurrent theme in my book, that the practitioners are often ahead of the academics. Renaissance Technologies, one of the most successful quantitative funds out there, the most successful actually, continues to run, for a while it ran, study groups where, you know, different people in the fund would read the academic finance literature and they would meet once a week and they would say, you know, can we trade this idea? Can we trade that idea? And they disbanded this study group, you know, after a year or two, because simply there was nothing in the academic literature that you could successfully trade. And when I went to see D.E. Shaw, the nearest thing that Renaissance has to a rival, it's the same story. They have a slightly low regard to the profitability from published research. But their own stuff, which they don't publish, appears to be making them a very handsome living. After Commodities Corporation, one cannot avoid George Soros. He is just the most gloriously schizophrenic person that any writer could hope to encounter. My favorite story about him concerns the Asian crisis. Let me just set the scene for you. So it's 1997, currency crises all over Asia, right? And the first one is Thailand, and they bet correctly in the Soros Fund that the Thai baht is going down, and they make $1 billion. Then the trouble spreads from Thailand. Indonesia's in trouble. Malaysia's in trouble. And in November of 1997, the locally based economist for the Soros Funds based in Hong Kong called Rodney Jones, he goes to South Korea. He shows up in Seoul and he visits a finance company. And on the wall of the finance company, there is a tombstone, one of those announcements that said, we did financing for XYZ company, you know, aren't we great? And Rodney Jones from Soros Funds looks at XYZ company and it says, a Thai real estate company. And Rodney Jones says, I've been to Thailand a lot. I know all these Thai real estate companies, and they're all bust. They're gone. They're not paying you back, are they? So if they're not paying you back, how come you guys are looking so cheerful? Why are you still afloat? And in fact, I can see several different tombstones from different Thai real estate companies. So don't give me this nonsense that you're still fine. And after some dissembling, the host admitted that, yes, it's true. The reason they're still afloat is that the South Korean Central Bank has been quietly giving them money under the table to keep them from imploding. And after three or four similar visits to different South Korean finance companies around Seoul, the guy from Soros has figured out that the central bank in South Korea is not telling the truth about its foreign exchange reserves. It's given these foreign exchange reserves under the table to its own financial system to keep it afloat, which means it has no ammunition left to defend the South Korean won from an attack by speculators, and one attack and they will devalue. Imagine the excitement. Another $1 billion profit is staring this guy in the face. He might get, let's just speculate, he might get 5% of the billion in his own personal bonus at the end of the year. $50 million, you can retire on that. He's looking pretty happy. He writes the memo. He sends it to headquarters in New York, to the Soros headquarters by Columbus Circle. And back from them, he gets radio silence. Nothing, no comment. So here he is, $50 million. He wants it, he wants it, he wants it. He writes the second memo. Come on guys, do the trade. And he gets nothing, radio silence. Then George Soros comes to South Korea. But he comes not to do the trade, but because he wants to be a philanthropist, a global statesman. There's a red carpet at the airport. He comes out of the plane. He makes a speech to the media about how speculators are bad. This is how you see them off. I recommend that your economic policy should be this, this, and this to frustrate those bad speculators. He goes to the Blue House, which is the presidential mansion in Seoul. And he meets with the newly elected president, and they discuss how markets are bad. They overshoot. They're destabilizing. And he's just decided that, you know, he's got two personalities. There's this personality over here, which is the speculator, and then there's the anti-speculator, and this week he's the anti-speculator. So I always wondered after that, you know, if I had been the Soros economist who had found the $50 million personal bonus opportunity and didn't get it because my boss has two personalities and that was just bad luck, it was the wrong week for me, how bitter might I have felt? And the answer is, I would have felt sufficiently bitter that if a writer had come to me 10 years later and said, do you know, by any chance, anything about what went on inside the Quantum Fund in this Asian crisis? I would have said, yeah, I do. And I've got 200 pages of real-time notes I took during the crisis, all the memos I sent to New York. I've got them all on PDF. I will email them to you right now. And you can ask me as many questions as you want, and you can reconstruct what happened inside the Soros funds from the inside in terrific detail. Now, that is one of the many lucky breaks I had in writing my book. I won't give you the long, you know, I won't give you the full Fidel Castro version of this speech. But suffice it to say, I had a fantastic time. And there were other cases. I mean, Julian Robertson, who ran the Tiger Funds very successfully between 1980 and 2000, he would write long letters to his investors every month. And I got the full set of letters over 20 years, and I was able to read the whole lot and go with that to interview all the people who worked for Julian Robertson. I went to see Paul Tudor Jones, one of the famous macro traders, and you know, he gave me memos that he'd written in the middle of the night when he had eureka moments in 2008 as Lehman Brothers was going down. And so I was able to amass really an enormous amount of stuff from inside these leading hedge funds and have a terrific time reconstructing the stories that make up the kind of highlights of the history of the industry, going through episodes like the dot-com crash, the breakup of LTCM, the collapse of Amaranth, and then the 2007 to 2009 crisis. So let me just sort of wrap it up by going back to the beginning of the talk and saying just a little bit more about the policy prescriptions. You know, is it really the case that hedge funds are potentially more stabilizing than other parts of the financial system? And my view is that, you know, the financial crisis that happened after I began to do my research and unfolded as I was thinking about the book and doing it, kind of was a vindication of my going-in hypothesis. Because in 2007, when most classes of investor, most types of institution, were losing a lot of money on the subprime bubble, hedge funds on average were up by 10%. So they dodged the bullet. In 2008, they were down, but they were down by only half as much as the S&P 500 stock index. So again, they managed the risk better than other people. Just as importantly, when they did go down, and of course lots of hedge funds did go bust, they were small enough to fail. They weren't too big to fail. They were small enough to fail, and they went down without costing taxpayers a single cent. And even more interestingly, not only did taxpayers not have to put money to bail out these guys, but creditors lost zero as well. And the reason is quite important to understand. A hedge fund marks its assets to market every day, and the creditors who've lent the money have great transparency into the fund, and they can see that they've lent their money against certain collateral, and if that collateral is going down in value, they have a margin call, and if it goes down too much, they just yank the whole loan. And so you wind up the hedge fund before it burns through its equity cushion. And so that's why when, for example, Amaranth, a big hedge fund that famously went bust in 2006, they had $9 billion, and then some Ferrari-driving, you know, young trader based in Calgary makes the wrong bets on natural gas, and they lose half the equity. It goes from $9 billion to $4.5 billion. At that point, the creditors say, enough already, we're closing this down. It takes a little time, a day or two, to negotiate the sale of the portfolio, in which time, you know, it goes down some more, but it's still got $3 billion of equity left in the fund. Again, $3 billion, one-third of the cushion, has not been exhausted. And so the creditors get 100 cents back on the dollar. And that's important because, as you all know, the way financial contagion can spread through the system is when creditors lose, and because they've lost money over here, they have to sell assets over there, they're selling in an illiquid environment, and so you get a kind of cascading effect, which is destabilizing for the whole system. So hedge funds were not a transmission mechanism for that kind of systemic trouble. You know, you had deposit-taking banks like Citigroup that got into trouble, had to be bailed out by the government. You had investment banks, whether it was Bear Stearns or Lehman or Merrill, or even Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, which ultimately had to be helped by the government to survive. Those guys proved to be destabilizing. You had money market mutual funds. They had to be backstopped by the government with a guarantee in the fall of 2008. You had insurance companies like AIG, again, had to be taken over by the government. Hedge funds were the exception. They were non-systemic. And so my view is, on the whole regulatory debate which we've had in Congress, and the passing of the Dodd-Frank legislation and the Basel III capital deal that we've just had. My view is that you've got to do that stuff with the bits of the system that messed up. You've got to regulate it better. But you shouldn't only do that. Regulators should also remember that we've had Basel I and Basel II before, and they didn't work. So we should be humble about whether Basel III will work better. So instead of only thinking about the bit of the system that messed up, you should pivot away from that train wreck and look at this bit over here, the system that didn't mess up. And when more financial risk is put into that piece of the system, where the incentives for managing the risk are better, regulators should be positively happy, because financial risk is not going away. Interest rates will go up and down. Currencies will fluctuate. There will be difficult decisions to make about how you allocate scarce capital between a biotech company over here or an alternative energy company over there. Finance is difficult, and there will be problems as a system of uncertain promises about an unknowable future. So there will be risk, and the question is, where do you want to house the risk? And you can put it in the too-big-to-fail institutions, but then taxpayers have to underwrite it. You can have mortgage products, which you sell to ordinary households, but then when they go wrong, the households are underwater, and you have a terrible problem around the country now where, you know, almost 25% of the people with mortgages have negative equity. Those are bad options about where you put financial risk. The good option is you put it in a private partnership where rich institutions have put their money at risk consciously and in a sophisticated way, and they can absorb the risk and they can take a loss if they need to. That is the systemically best option. And so my view at the end of this book is that to an important degree, the future of a stable financial system is to be found in the history of hedge funds. Thank you very much.
We'll continue the discussion with questions. I think a good place to start is a discussion of leverage in hedge funds compared with other financial tools. Mm-hmm. You didn't address that directly, and perhaps that would be a good starting place.
Yes. Too much leverage is dangerous, and it doesn't matter if you're a hedge fund or some other kind of institution. And so the really interesting question is, you know, do hedge funds, in fact, lever more than others? And because of the famous case of long-term capital management, which blew up in 1998, and they were very levered, they were 25-1 levered, people think that hedge funds are extremely levered. The truth is actually not the case. The average hedge fund has leverage of around 2 to 1, maybe 3 to 1. So it's about an order of magnitude less than long-term capital management, and also an order of magnitude less than, you know, Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs and all those other investment banks on the eve of the crisis. So they're less levered than the commercial banks too, by the way. Because of this point that hedge fund managers tend to have their own personal savings in the fund, you know, their skin is in the game, so they don't overdo the leverage.
You did mention high-frequency trading, yeah. And we have several questions on that. For the first part of that, can you describe your view of its role in the May 6th flash crash?
Sure.
And also your view of high-frequency trading as a possible either cause of instability or the reverse in the markets?
Sure. Well, the answer on the May 6th flash crash, when, for those of you who didn't follow this, basically equities fell very sharply and then corrected in 20 minutes. So it was a 20-minute sort of panic. And there's still, I think, we're still waiting for the SEC post-mortem, which they've put a lot of effort into trying to reconstruct exactly what went wrong. The early indications I've had from friends of mine who are sort of part of the consultations on what went on don't actually suggest that high-frequency trading was much to do with it. So I have an open mind. I mean, you know, we'll see what this report says, but I don't expect that high-frequency trading is the culprit. What I do think is that people should remember that computers are actually better at keeping their nerves in a crisis than people are, for the good reason that computers don't have nerves. All right, and so the problem in a crisis, as in 1987 when the market crashed in October, was that in the midst of a crash, brokers and market makers just don't answer the telephone. You know, you're trying to sell and you can't because no one's picking up your call. And so there's no market, there's no liquidity, and that in that condition, prices can gap downwards very sharply. And it can take longer to recover. The flash crash was over in 20 minutes, I think, partly because computerized systems can, you know, they don't freak out so much as people do, and they can kind of correct and go back into buying mode much more rapidly.
To bore down a bit further on the larger issue of speed in modern finance and its effect on market volatility, the question is, how might the increasing use of machine learning black box trading systems affect both efficiency and volatility of stock, commodity, and money markets? What happens when black box meets black swan?
You can have black swan in the absence of black box. And of course, there have been black swans. There have been financial crises, famously going back to the tulips. But all through the 19th century, on a fairly regular basis, there were banking crises. And so the kind of instinct to associate financial crashes with modern technology is wrong. I mean, we've had these crashes for a long time. So we have to be a bit more thoughtful about, I think, you know, figuring out what the connection is. And it's complex. I mean, sometimes, you know, the fact that computers allow you to sell faster than you could do it manually means that you might go down faster when everybody wants to sell. Maybe that could create a kind of overshooting effect. And that view, that worried view, is a plausible view. But I've never seen anyone demonstrate that convincingly, and I think on the in the case of the black swan, in the case of the moment of panic, whether fast trading is good or bad, I think there's no conclusive position on that. Circuit breakers are a healthy way of preventing overshooting, whether or not you have computerized trading. They were instituted in a bigger way after 1987 to respond to human freakouts, and they're going to be instituted now in a better way after the flash crash of May in response to that episode. So I think circuit breakers are healthy. But we should also remember that black swans are only there in a very small proportion of the time. And for normal market conditions, there's no doubt that markets are made more liquid and more efficient and cheaper to transact in when you have lots of rapid computerized trading going on, for the obvious reason that if I'm coming to sell one day because I'm a pension fund, let's say, and I've got claims from, you know, retirees, I've got to write them a check, so I've got to sell some assets over here. So I want to go and I want to sell. And what I want is to sell at the given price without the market moving against me as I sell. The more people who are trading, and the more frequently prices are updated, the easier it is for me to sell. And I don't have to worry that markets will happen to be illiquid when I'm about to sell. And because I don't have a liquidity risk, I will pay more for assets. The cost of capital will go down across the economy as financial assets become more liquid. People, I think, don't always see this. You know, the cost of that capital is materially affected by the ease of the trading in the secondary markets. So people often say to me in these talks, what's the point of all this, you know, churning of assets on a short-term basis? What does that do for the economy? Well, actually, quite a lot, because liquidity in secondary markets make those secondary markets easier to do an IPO into. If the IPO is easier, then the venture capitalist is more likely to commit money because the exit strategy is there for him. So I think there are ripple effects on the cost of capital through the system.
You mentioned that transparency to creditors is a way that hedge funds were stable in the recent crisis. What features should be adopted for the regular banking system in terms of transparency? Is transparency viable only because hedge funds are, quote unquote, small?
Yeah. I mean, transparency is actually a can of worms. So I think this is a reflexive tendency to say, you know, more transparency is always good, markets function on information, how can you have too much transparency? there are moments when it's actually kind of productive. So, for example, in several of the stories, the blow-ups that I describe in my book, what happens if you take, for example, Julian Robertson, who I mentioned earlier, the manager of the Tiger Fund. You know, by the late 90s, he was so successful and so big, he was managing $20 billion, which is a huge amount in the 1990s, that when he sent his monthly letters out, you know, people would jump on these things, they would fax them to all their friends, people followed what he said very, very closely. And when, you know, he would have a victory, he would say, you know, I bought a big position in U.S. Airways, it's really worked out well. You know, now people know he's in U.S. Airways, so he's got some transparency on that. And they know he's got a big position. And then, you know, they remember that, and then a year later, Julian Robertson makes a big loss on a bet on the yen-dollar exchange rate. And people are thinking to themselves, okay, he's lost money in this currency bet, so now he's going to be over-levered because his capital has been eroded by that loss, so he's going to have to dump something. We know he's got U.S. Airways. He might dump some U.S. Airways, so we're going to sell ahead of him. So it was the transparency of the knowledge of his fund actually allowed predatory traders to jump on him. And that's the same with the long-term capital management blow-up. In many of these episodes, transparency can actually hasten the collapse. So I don't want to pretend it's a simple, I think it's actually a more subtle debate than most people think.
Let's talk about the what has been described in the current papers as the currency war. Mm-hmm. There's been a series of recent intervention by central banks in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, in an effort to make their currencies cheaper. China has continued to suppress the value of its currency, and Brazil's finance minister yesterday asserted that an international currency war has broken out. According to your book, this ought to be an opportunity for hedge fund managers. Who wins and who loses in this situation?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that the classic battles between central banks and hedge funds of the 1990s that I describe, having to do with Europe in 1992, when the exchange rate mechanism blew up and Soros made $1 billion betting against the central bank in Britain. Before that, he made a lot of money in Italy. You know, and there were certain other kind of, you know, Sweden also had a currency crash, which again, although people didn't know this before, but actually Soros made another $1 billion. This time he didn't talk about it because he got so much bad publicity from being the guy who broke the Bank of England that when he broke the Bank of Sweden as well, he didn't talk. But, you know, those battles and also the ones in the Asian crisis had to do with governments trying to prop up the value of their currency, trying to avoid devaluation. And that's a battle that central banks can lose, right? Because to prop up your currency, you have to buy it, right? And you have to buy it with foreign exchange. And when you run out of foreign exchange, as the South Koreans did, because they'd already given it to their banks, you're cooked. You lose. The hedge funds beat you. It's different now because central banks are actually trying to push down the value of their currency in order to be able to export more, and it's a kind of beggar thy neighbor war to get demand. The global economy has a shortage of demand, and everybody's trying to grab everybody else's demand by having a weak currency. Now, when you want to make your currency weaker, you have to sell your own currency. Now, you can print your own currency, right? So you have an unlimited stockpile of ammunition that you can print and keep on selling it. So it's not an obvious trade for hedge funds, I think.
Well, one of the characteristics of hedge funds, obviously, is the short-long. And there was a lot of public criticism in the 2008 crisis about piling on the shorts. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my sense is that I haven't come across an episode where the victim of a short-selling raid went down without deserving to. In other words, there's normally something fundamental about the management of the victim that made it ripe for attack. Now, the most extreme recent case of this, just to illustrate what I'm talking about, is Greece. Okay, so Greece says, our budget deficit is 3% of GDP. And then they say, whoops, it's actually 13%. We've been lying to you guys for the last 3 years. And then they say, it's the market's fault that we have a problem. No, come on. I mean, if you run a 13% of GDP budget deficit, and you lie about it, you cannot blame somebody else for your trouble. And that's an extreme case, but I think if you actually look at, you know, the assets that Lehman Brothers was holding on its books, the way that, you know, the mismatch between very short-term funding and investments in positions that they couldn't sell very easily, they basically just took too much risk. And in the environment of 2008, that was a mistake which was going to kill them. And in the post-mortems after 2008, where I think a court-appointed investigator went and looked at what Lehman was holding, it was even worse than we thought in 2008. So, you know, it's easy to blame the bear raids, the short sellers, and say, you guys caused it. No, you didn't cause it. You know, these guys, you know, the Lehmans and the Bear Stearns, they went down because they mismanaged their own risks, and that's why they went out of business.
To address another aspect of hedge funds, how did redemptions affect hedge funds in 2008, both from the standpoint of the fund losing money, but also from the standpoint of the investor who wanted the money back and possibly couldn't get it?
Yeah. So what happened was that, you know, after the Lehman Brothers collapse in September, as you know, nobody was willing to lend to anybody else. I mean, the whole money market system of lending from one bank to another completely froze up. And an aspect of everybody trying to hoard cash was that people were trying to pull money out of anything they had money in. So the money market funds had to be backstopped by the government because people might pull money out of that. Hedge funds were not immune to this phenomenon. People just wanted to pull money out, partly actually because a lot of the endowments which had invested in hedge funds had also invested in private equity. And the deals with private equity, of course, lock up your money for a lot longer. So there were some things you couldn't pull money out of, so you pulled it where you could pull it. And hedge funds often had rules where every quarter you were supposed to be able to redeem what you put in there. So people were calling money out. And in some cases, you know, they got their money back, and they were allowed to get it back, and the consequence was that hedge funds had to sell the assets that they had bought with that money in a bad market, which is why hedge funds were down, as I said, quite a lot in 2008, or they were only half as much down as the market index. So to the extent that they lost, this was a big reason. It was a forced fire sale by the process of their investors yanking money out. In some cases, hedge funds figured that if they were forced to give money back and therefore sell assets in that environment, it would be so catastrophic in terms of the losses that it would be fairer to the investors who were actually staying in the fund not to allow others to pull money out. So they locked people in. They said, you know, and to be fair, the contracts that they had signed with the investors allowed them to do this. Otherwise, they would have been sued forever. So they were exercising a legal right, which they had with their investors. The investors hated it. I keep on being told by investors and fund-to-fund managers that, you know, this was the most despicable, you know, action by hedge fund sleazeballs that they'd ever come across. I have a different view. I mean, I think that, you know, they signed a legal agreement that allowed them to lock up the money if they needed to. They locked it up for a good reason, which was this was a moment when it was awful to sell assets of any kind. And they locked people in, and then when markets stabilized in 2009, they were mostly able to just give the money back or at least remove the lock. And if you think about it also, if you go back to the kind of the bigger question of the stability of the financial system, what do lockups do to that? And the answer is that it's a fantastic mechanism because you're imposing sort of, you're imposing discomfort and pain on investors who actually can take it. You're not turning to taxpayers to bail you out. You have an internal mechanism to kind of augment your capital by locking it in. Just when you need it. Right now, there's a debate with banks about issuing contingent convertible bonds, that are bonds that will convert into equity in a crisis. It's quite difficult to design these things, but a lot of financial engineers think that's a solution. Hedge funds kind of have a kind of ready-made contingent convertible bond, and they have callable money, which they can lock up if they need to. So I think systemically, it's actually a healthy feature.
Let's move to another aspect of hedge funds, the compensation structure, and start with the general, and then we can go to the specific. One reviewer of your book wrote the following: currently, many of my loved ones are out of work, and like the majority of Americans, I can never afford a hedge fund, and I didn't make money off the credit crisis. Hedge funds have contributed to an outsized atmosphere of greed and a growing imbalance of wealth for years. What is your response to the many Americans who sympathize with that comment?
Well, in some sense, I do too, because I make a distinction between the healthy risk management that hedge funds do and the outsized more money than God profits that they earn. And these are analytically distinct. For example, I think you could, I know that policy should be changed such that the current tax treatment of hedge fund profits, I think, should be changed. Why should the earnings of a hedge fund manager be taxed at the capital gains rate when the person who fixes his computer, is being taxed at the income tax rate? I think we should change that. So I believe inequality in the United States is a big issue, and I think that a small contribution to addressing this is to change the tax treatment of hedge fund profits.
In 2006, hedge fund managers earned over $25 billion among themselves. How much did they earn in 2009? Did that come back?
Well, the number for 2009 is that the top 25 made a combined $25 billion.
In 2009?
Yeah. So in other words, the average take-home profits for the top 25 was $1 billion each. I think in 2006, Lloyd Blankfein was the highest paid executive on Wall Street, and Goldman Sachs paid him $54 million. So these guys are making $1 billion. I mean, they're making 20 times more.
Let's move to another subject, the Volcker Rule,
yeah.
Which is designed to reduce proprietary trading and reduce conflicts of interest. Is this helpful to the system in general? Is it particularly helpful to true hedge funds?
Yeah, I mean, I completely support the sentiment behind the Volcker Rule, which is that you shouldn't have hedge funds hidden inside too big to fail institutions that the taxpayers are backstopping. My case in favor of hedge funds is a case in favor of small, freestanding, entrepreneurial boutiques that manage risk without getting help from the government, which are not too big to fail, which are small enough to fail. That's what I like about it. I don't like it when the same strategies are migrated into the middle of a big bank, where you can then take tons of risk and figure that the taxpayers will bail you out if you get it wrong. That's not healthy. So the Volcker Rule says, or the sentiment when it was proposed, was that you would spin proprietary trading out of the banks and the investment banks, and it would presumably go off into freestanding hedge funds. And further, that hedge funds, which were subsidiaries of big banks, should be non-subsidiaries. They should be separated. This was a terrific idea. I note in my book that the hedge funds that did go wrong most famously in the crisis were the Bear Stearns hedge funds, a subsidiary of a bank. The Goldman Sachs hedge fund was recapitalized by the parent as well. UBS had trouble with its hedge funds. JP Morgan never admitted it did, but I'm pretty sure it did recapitalize quietly its hedge fund subsidiary. And I think this is not a coincidence. The guys running these hedge funds that were part of the big banks knew they had deep-pocketed parents, and so they could take too much risk, and they would be recapitalized if they messed up. And equally, when they raised money, they didn't have to go to investors and say, I'm, you know, somebody you've never heard of running a small hedge fund, but look at my track record, and I'll explain to you why you should entrust your precious money to me, because here's how I'm going to do it. If you were at Bear Stearns, you just went and said, look, I'm Bear Stearns, you've heard of my bank, here's my brand, give me the money. I mean, that's sort of just much easier to raise money. It's much easier to raise money if you have a I exaggerate for effect, but it's easier to raise the money if you have a big brand behind your head than it is if you're a boutique startup, right? And so I think the barriers to raising money are lower, and the incentive to take too much risk with the money are bigger when you're inside inside the big institution. Unfortunately, the implementation of the Volcker Rule is going to be a mess. And for example, I chatted with a guy at Goldman Sachs on the weekend who explained to me that prop trading was moving out of Goldman and moving into the Goldman subsidiary that's GSAM, which is the asset management subsidiary of Goldman. Big deal. I mean, it's still part of Goldman. If the prop traders who are now part of the subsidiary get into trouble They will be rescued by the parent, just like Citigroup felt obliged to take these supposedly off-balance sheet SIVs and take them back onto their balance sheet. It's the yo-yo thing. You think you've given it away, but it comes back to you when it's in trouble.
Could you compare the rate of failure of hedge funds historically and in the recent crisis?
Hedge funds have historically always gone through periods of attrition. And so, in the 60s, A.W. Jones, who'd started kind of under the radar, he'd been this secretive guy running missions for the anti-Nazi left, and he carried on being secretive when he started his hedge fund. In the 50s, nobody had ever heard of him. And then in the 60s, he was sort of outed because he just made so much money, did so well. He was making returns which were pretty much the same as Warren Buffett in this period. People came to hear about what he'd done. And then there was a wave of imitator funds. There was a big boom in hedge funds. You could go back and find late 1960s magazine articles in The Economist and Forbes and so forth about this. And then the market collapsed at the end of the 60s, and a lot of these hedge funds weren't actually hedged. They all blew up, and there was huge attrition. So this has been a feature of the industry of kind of waves of growth and then falling back a bit. In the 2000s, when I looked at some numbers, I think that in the average year, almost 1,000 hedge funds went out of business. Maybe 800 or so went out of business. In the crisis, it went up to 1,500 in a single year, went out of business. So people make mistakes and they go out, but they don't do it at the expense of the taxpayer.
If you were an energetic young man or woman today, would you go into venture capital or private equity or hedge funds? We were discussing earlier that in Northern California, and this will be uplinked throughout the United States, but venture capital and private equity are really a larger part of our financial world here, rather than true hedge funds.
Right. So at the risk of causing some offense, here is my reading of the academic literature on these different types of investment vehicle. The best literature on hedge fund performance comes from a guy called Roger Ibbotson at Yale, and it looks at a data set spanning 15 years with about 8,000 hedge funds and corrected for various biases in the data, and it looks at what the investors get to keep after you take away those enormous hedge fund fees. And the answer is that hedge funds are delivering about 3 percentage points a year of uncorrelated returns, which is a fantastic deal for institutional investors. You really want that. You want diversified sources of return, and hedge funds are actively delivering that. And it's not just a few stars, the kind of famous people who I write about in my book. It's a big data set of a lot of funds. So I'm convinced that hedge funds deliver value. When you do the same kind of inquiry about private equity, you find a different result. Private equity, of course, is taking public companies and making them private, putting debt in, and then trying to manage them better than they'd been managed before. And so the question is this just leverage beta? In other words, exposure to the S&P 500 index, basically, but with more debt in it? Or is it actually delivering alpha, in other words, an uncorrelated return associated with better management practices? And the literature says that on average, in private equity, there is no alpha. It's leverage beta. This was a conclusion I reached by consulting with Josh Lerner at Harvard Business School, who knows the literature very well, has contributed to it. And, there are a variety of papers on this, but basically that's the consensus, that there's not very strong evidence that private equity actually contributes value. Some private equity companies certainly do, but on average the sector does not. Then if you look at venture capital, it's a more positive story. That does contribute a lot. So that would lead me to say that, venture capital is a good calling, and hedge funds are a good calling, and it depends what you prefer to do. Do you prefer to go kick the tires of small ventures and look in the eyes of the managers and figure out who's got the fire in his belly and who's going to make it work? Or do you prefer, in a more kind of mathematical way, to look at relationships between traded securities? What suits you? I mean, if you're Jim Simons, the code breaker who set up Renaissance Technologies based on the algorithms you use for cracking enemy code, clearly it's better to do hedge funds because you can't use that high order mathematics when you do venture capital, or at least it's less central to venture capital.
So it looks like there's a tie in the beauty contest. The winners are venture capital and hedge funds. So as a final question, in a beauty contest among the hedge fund managers about whom you wrote in your book, do you have a favorite? And if so, I'm sure you do. If you would, as your final answer, if you could discuss him.
Well, maybe I'll go with this guy, Jim Simons, who set up Renaissance Technologies and the Medallion Fund, which is the kind of the flagship fund there. Since 1990, has been up massively every year, probably on the order of 50 or 60%, sometimes as much as 160%. They at one point charged fees of 4% for management and 44% for profit share, and people were desperate to get into it, and then they actually refused to get anyone more into it, and they only reserved the fund for the people who work there and for people, a few people who used to work there. But the culture of that place has created such a success story that it's intellectually fascinating. I think, the only writer who's ever been to visit the campus on Long Island where they do this stuff. And, you know, Jim Simons came out of the Institute for Defense Analyses, and he had applied, you know, math to sweeping through enemy code where you don't have any clue as to what the code means. There are no sort of fundamental data, you don't get a grammar book with it. You just have to look at the data and try and figure what the patterns are, and from that, try to decode what it's telling you. In fact, Elwin Belkamp, who's a mathematician at Berkeley, likened this process, he worked at Renaissance for a bit, likened this process to, you know, in military communications, which he'd also worked in, sometimes there are soldiers on the battlefield who need to send messages up to air cover, which must be so wispy and translucent that the enemy doesn't even know that you are transmitting code, because there's so much random noise around the signal that they think it's just random noise. And that's like a financial market. It's mainly efficient, therefore most of the movement is random, but in there is a little bit of signal, and if you can find that with the same algorithms that you use in code cracking, you could find patterns that are profitable to trade. And then, in fact, they brought in a new kind of source of talent, which were people who'd worked in the IBM research lab doing computerized translation. And typically in computerized translation before the revolution came, which I'll tell you about in a second, the idea was, you know, you teach a computer to translate from French into English by taking a grammar book and teaching it the rules of French grammar. Along came two guys at IBM and said, you know, forget that, we'll go to Canada, we'll get the parliamentary record in Canada, which has reams of French and reams of English, and we will feed all that language into the computer and tell the computer to go figure out the correlations between the different sentences of French and English. And this turned out to be a far more effective way of teaching computers how to translate. And out of this came a revolution in statistical machine translation. The same guys who did that invention were then hired into this hedge fund, and they contributed a lot to the code crackers. They'd used some of the same mathematics as in code cracking. And together they created this kind of weird sort of PhD kind of faculty of code breakers, who applied that approach to markets. And when I went to the office, you know, there were these weird mirrors in the corner of the corridors. And I said, well, what's that about? And he said, well, you know, one of our people, you know, likes to go around on a unicycle, so it's important to have mirrors so you can see if he's coming around the corner, otherwise he'll smash right into you. So it was an interesting culture and intellectually fascinating, and the success has certainly been more money than godlike.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. And so on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Council on Foreign Relations, we want to thank Sebastian Mallaby for his insightful comments tonight. Thank you. Let me remind you that Mr. Mallaby will be signing copies of his books up front with Books, Inc. is with us tonight with copies of More Money Than God.
Nancy, well done, guys, always.
See, you're going to come over, aren't you?
Yes.
Good. I'm so glad. Good. Yeah, good.
Look forward to catching
up. Yeah, you're in actually Washington.
I am. I'm going back tonight.
I was delighted to see that you could be here.